I'm supposed to be a moderator today, and most people would say, how could you be moderate on campaign financing? But I will do my best to moderate this panel and to keep it moving. And we're going to keep it, it's going to be very, very quick. The speakers don't have very much time to speak. You don't have a whole lot of time for questions, so I want to keep your questions very short. But let's really keep it, we'll keep it moving. Susan Lerner is one of the most persuasive advocates for campaign reform in California. She's executive director of the California Clean Money Campaign. She's also involved in judicial elections at the federal level through the Justice for All Project. And she was a trial lawyer for 20 years. So panelists, beware here. Susan knows how to persuade a jury, and here is her jury, more than 12 people. Tom McClintock is Republican state senator from Thousand Oaks, admired by both Democrats and Republicans for speaking his mind as a candidate for governor during the recall election in 2003. I think Tom emerged as had the highest poll rating of admiration of anybody who was in that race. He was elected at age 26 to the California State Assembly. 26. He ran for state controller in 2002 and lost by the narrowest margin in California history. He lost by 16,000 votes out of over 7 million votes cast. So Tom suffered through that election in many ways. Dan Schnur, one of the most respected and quoted political observers in the state. He's a political consultant, a media advisor. He's former press secretary to Governor Wilson. He was National Director of Communications for the 2000 presidential campaign for John McCain. And we might ask him, will he be the Communications Director for the 2008 presidential campaign for John McCain? That might be a question you could ask him. He's taught at Berkeley and now teaches at USC. Let me give you a little background very quickly on the subject and give you some rules that as you consider whether or not to change campaign financing, let me give you the rules that you have to live under. And these are rules by the United States Supreme Court, so it's the highest court in the land. And there's some things you can do, and there are some things that you cannot do. We've had campaign finance reform since 1974, basically, since the Watergate era. The federal campaign finance law passed in the 70s. The California Political Reform Act passed in 1974. We've been living with that since the 70s. Now, the important thing to remember is the 1976 United States Supreme Court decision called Buckley versus Valeo, and they set down what you can do and what you can't do in terms of campaign financing. You may not limit spending in campaigns unless there is public financing, unless candidates agree voluntarily to limit their spending and accept public financing. So, rule number one. If you want to limit campaign spending, you have to adopt a public financing system. You may, however, limit contributions. For example, suppose Tom is running. I guess he's going to be running for lieutenant governor coming up. Suppose I think Tom is absolutely terrific. I can give Tom contributions up to $5,000 under state rule. That's it. I can't give him more than $5,000. When he was running for governor, I could have given him $20,000 or maybe $21,000. California has very high contribution limits. So I can be limited how much I could give Tom. But if I liked Tom, I really thought he was terrific, and I gave him the maximum amount of contributions, I can also go out and make independent expenditures on behalf of Tom, as long as he and I didn't talk to each other, as long as he didn't tell me, hey, go out and buy some billboards or TV time, and here's what you should say. The Supreme Court has said, while you can limit the contributions to Tom, because the court says a large contribution to Tom either corrupts Tom or creates the appearance of corruption. If I give him $100,000, $500,000, it creates the appearance of corruption. But if I go out and spend the money independently, don't even talk to Tom, the Supreme Court has said there is no corruption or appearance of corruption. So Tom can spend as much as he wants on his campaign. The court has said there is no corruption problems there if Tom spends unlimited amounts of money. Suppose everybody gave Tom $1 and he spent $100 million, for example. Everybody in the country gave him $1 and he spent $100 million. The court said there's no corruption there. But there is corruption on contributions, limiting contributions. Also, while we're not probably going to get into this, just to let you know, on ballot measure committees, as Bill Jones said, you cannot stop paid circulators. Court has ruled it's unconstitutional. You cannot limit how much is spent on ballot measure campaigns. That's unconstitutional. You can't limit how much a person gives to a ballot measure campaign. That's unconstitutional. So as you're thinking about solutions, you have to think about what the court said. Now, you can have disclosure. And California has been ranked by Kim Alexander, the California Voter Foundation, as the number one, the best state in campaign disclosure. We can obviously always improve, but so there can be disclosure, you can limit contributions, and you can have spending limits if the candidate agrees to public financing. So you have to have a public financing system. And there is public financing in a number of states and a number of cities and counties. California, we have public financing in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Oakland, Long Beach, and Sacramento. New Jersey has public financing, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota. And then there are two states that Susan probably will be talking about, although she only has 5 minutes, so talk for Susan. There are two states that have clean money, and that's Arizona and Maine. And they've had several elections under both under the clean money system. So those are sort of the options that you can be thinking about. Or maybe we shouldn't have any reform laws. Maybe we should have campaign disclosure. There should be no limits whatsoever. California didn't have limits really until after 1996. And maybe we should have full disclosure, or maybe we shouldn't even have disclosure. There is actually a group that has filed a lawsuit saying there should be no disclosure in ballot measure campaigns. And they've said it's unconstitutional. That's an invasion of privacy. So those are your range of options. These are your speakers. They're going to talk about some of these options, and we'll start with Susan Lerner.
Thanks, Bob. I'm really glad that we're starting with campaign finance reform in the first session, because I firmly believe the campaign finance reform, and particularly full public financing of elections, is an important predicate to the kinds of governmental reform that we're going to be talking about throughout the day today. There's a basic fallacy in our current system of campaign finance. We ask our candidates and elected officials to spend 6 to 12 hours a day personally raising the money necessary to run for office, which, here in California, can total millions of dollars. And the reality of elections in California means that once they are successful on election day, they must almost immediately start raising money for the next race. At the same time, we ask them to pretend that they're not beholden to the very people who just bankrolled their campaigns, that all of their constituents receive the same consideration and access to their elected officials. This past Sunday, the LA Times ran a page one article that revealed that large campaign donors to the various Schwarzenegger campaign committees receive a special phone number to call to gain access to the governor's staff. These large donors also receive special telephone briefings from the governor's advisors in which they have an opportunity to have their questions answered and to voice their opinions privately and directly to those helping make policy. This from a governor who advanced as his major selling point that he was so rich he didn't need to be bought. If such a privately wealthy elected official still feels the need to take huge amounts of campaign donations and provide special access in return, what hope is there that the general public will believe that any less wealthy official can be insulated from the corrosive influence of mega campaign bucks? It's little wonder that the public does not believe that the concerns of ordinary Californians are heard in Sacramento over the voices of those who have paid large amounts for special access, whether they are corporate donors or labor unions. There's a commonly held presumption that donors currently set the agenda at all levels of government, even if an elected official with a clear set of firmly held beliefs only approaches donors whom he or she knows already share those beliefs, the public believes that the politician is dancing to the donor's tune. Thus, in the current jaded public view, Republicans always do corporate bidding while Democrats are in the pocket of labor unions. It doesn't matter that someone can be a principled Republican who believes fervently in the curative power of unfettered markets, or that a Democrat could enter the state house a firm trade unionist because of their family's personal experiences. To a distrustful and disenchanted public, they are equally suspect and not accountable to the people who elected them. How to change the sorry state of affairs? Certainly, we have seen that the current system of imposing contribution limits and requiring disclosures hasn't worked. Some would argue that's because the limits are too high, making it harder for candidates to run by forcing them to chase larger numbers of smaller donations in perpetual campaigns. I suggest is not the solution. What's needed is not campaign finance reform, but campaign innovation. The most exciting and practical innovation, I believe, is full public financing of election campaigns, the clean money system. It's a system which is working successfully today in Arizona and Maine, as Bob pointed out. Under clean money, candidates who prove their viability by showing a broad base of support refuse private donations and agree to spending limits and receive public funds to enable them to run competitive campaigns. The system is completely voluntary. Candidates who don't wish to participate are able to raise and spend private money for their campaigns as they do today. Clean money is an important first step in helping voters take back control over politics. With public funding of elections, candidates and elected officials spend their time talking with voters, not dialing for dollars. They're more accountable and responsive to the voters, not campaign donors. They don't have campaign donors. With clean money, elections become a contest of ideas rather than a race for the biggest campaign war chest. And we've seen in Arizona and Maine that voter turnout increases. Another benefit is that people from many different backgrounds have a fair shot at getting elected without owing favors to special interest groups, donors, and lobbyists. It helps us move closer to the ideal of the citizen legislator, so that more good people from diverse backgrounds with new ideas help to shape public policy. In Maine, the clean money system enabled a politically active waitress, well known in her community, to run for the state legislature and win. Finally, clean money encourages public officials to focus on laws that benefit all voters, not large campaign contributors. Arizona's cleanly elected governor was able to make good on her promise to help control the cost of prescription drugs. In Maine, with cleanly elected majorities in both houses of the legislature, they've adopted a form of universal health care. The cost of adopting a clean money system in California is modest, approximately $5 annually for each adult Californian. This is a reasonable amount to help provide Californians with a government that they deserve, one that takes into account the needs of all citizens, is honest, open, and accountable, and promotes fairness. Instituting a clean money system here in California, we believe, can help us achieve these goals.
Thank you, Susan. Susan did a terrific job of staying within the time because we only have 5 minutes. Now, Mark here, by the way, panelists, is going to be holding up when you have 1 minute left, and then we're going to cut you off after. We'll give you another minute or so. Tom.
Well, thank you, Bob. Personally, I like campaign finance restrictions. I've got over 80% statewide name ID now, and anything you can do to limit a challenger's ability to overcome that is okay with me. And I like Susan's idea over public financing. That also would be very helpful. If I've got 80% name ID and my opponent's got 30%, I'm quite all right with each of us spending an equal amount of money. Thank you very much. But it would be bad public policy, so don't do it, because it creates a host of unintended consequences. And this is the most important point. It doesn't change the amount of money that is spent to influence elections. Every attempt to impose restrictions on campaign financing runs afoul of a basic and immutable reality. The more money that government controls, the more money will be spent to control the government. The only question is what course that money is going to take. In a free society, that money takes a direct course. A donor gives to a candidate. And by the way, my experience is the vast proportion of donors give to candidates who are already of like mind. I frankly have never understood the shock and amazement of some people when they find out, for example, that pro-abortion groups give to pro-abortion candidates and anti-abortion groups give to anti-abortion candidates. How shocking. But there is no denying that some donors give money with an intent to curry favor or to gain access. And we should be on our guard of how campaign contributions might tip the balance in a candidate's attention or thinking, particularly on narrow issues that are of great importance to individual special interests. That, by the way, is why sunshine laws are so important. People should be able to see where the money that is backing a candidate is coming from, and the candidate ought to be accountable for how those funds are spent. But beware. Restrictions don't change the basic problem, and they make it much harder for people to see where a candidate's support is coming and how, and it makes it much harder to hold that candidate accountable for how that money is spent. The reason is because when restrictions are imposed, either as limits or in conjunction with public financing, they radically change the course that the money flows. Instead of going directly to the candidates where the public can see who's backing that candidate, it flows instead to independent committees and political parties that are often shielded from public view. Instead of the candidate being accountable for how that money is spent, independent committees can send out the most scurrilous material imaginable, while the beneficiary of that material can rightly disavow any responsibility for it. So you end up with the same amount of money being spent and the same concerns over influence, but with much less public scrutiny and much less accountability than we once had. But there's even a more pernicious effect of these restrictions. They strengthen the advantages that wealthy candidates and that incumbents already enjoy. The wealthy always start out with a huge lead in fundraising. Incumbents usually start with a huge lead in name recognition. These are advantages that challengers have got to work overtime to overcome. But in a free environment, occasionally they do. But when you begin restricting contributions to smaller and smaller amounts, those candidates of modest means have to devote more and more of their time and resources to chasing more and more donors until the task simply becomes prohibitive. Replacing private financing with public financing faces the same basic problem. Whether or not public money is involved, those with interests in the outcome of an election will use their resources in an infinite variety of ways to influence that election. All you've done is artificially added to the costs of the campaign by adding taxpayer funds to the equation. Now, just a few weeks ago, we had an election in Los Angeles. Now, they have both very strict limits and public financing. And I direct your attention to Jeffrey Rabin's article in the Los Angeles Times on Monday. Unchecked independent spending is playing an increasingly large role in Los Angeles elections, despite city campaign finance restrictions that sought to limit the influence of big money donors. Independent spending by non-candidates has exploded from less than $300,000 in 1993, the first mayor's race under finance restrictions, to more than $4.2 million in this year's campaign. Under the city's campaign finance system, approved by voters in 1990, strict limits were imposed on how much money could be directed or could be given directly to candidates and how much the candidates could spend on their own campaigns. Campaign contributions from individuals were matched by city taxpayers, a change designed to reduce the influence of businesses and labor unions. Donors soon found they could bypass the city's contribution limits by waging their own campaigns for or against candidates, unquote. That's not to say that there's nothing that should be done. Louis Brandeis was right. Sunlight is the best of disinfectants. As long as the public can see who is contributing to candidates, they can make informed judgments of the candidate's sympathies and loyalties and views. Ironically, campaign finance restrictions obstruct this transparency by forcing money into independent groups. Now, let me conclude by pointing out that this is not a new issue. And all the reading material for this event that the Commonwealth Club helpfully suggested, I was surprised that not included in that was perhaps the most classic tract on the subject, Madison's Federalist Number 10, where he addressed exactly the same question. How do you keep special interests, he called them factions, from corrupting the process? He said, "Liberty is to faction what air is to fire, an aliment without which it instantly expires. But it could not be less folly to abolish liberty, which is essential to political life because it nourishes faction, than it would be to wish the annihilation of air, which is essential to animal life because it imparts to fire its destructive agency." In other words, you can restrict freedom, which is what the supporters of campaign finance restrictions advocate, but you may not like the result. Or you can preserve freedom, safe in the knowledge that where special interests are free to compete openly and in the sunlight, their self-interests ultimately cancel each other out. Labor and management, plaintiff and defendant, taxpayer and tax consumer all settle into a rough equilibrium. That is the great assumption that democracies make, and that assumption is sound. Let us stand by it.
Thank you very much, and thank you for limiting the remarks to the amount of time. Dan, you're in the middle here. Are you in the middle between Susan and Tom in terms of policy?
I am. I can be the moderator if you don't feel comfortable in that role. First of all, I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club for sponsoring not just this panel, but this entire day of discussion. I think it's a tremendous thing to do, and I appreciate being asked to participate in it. But I'd also like to congratulate each of you in this audience for voluntarily deciding to take an hour to hour and a half of your time to sit through a discussion of campaign finance reform. When I went to work for Senator McCain's presidential campaign in 1999, what we discovered very quickly is that the average voter did not know the difference between soft money and fabric softener, nor did they care. But what they did care very deeply about were concerns that their government, that their elections were being taken away from them by moneyed interests to which they had no part. And if you were a Republican, you point with great alarm to the unions and to George Soros and to MoveOn.org. If you are a Democrat, you point to the business community and to Richard Mellon Scaife and to their allies with equal alarm. But regardless of the individual's political or partisan orientation, what we found is people feeling like they were being shut out of an election process because while they got one vote, there were moneyed interests on both sides of the partisan sense that got partisan fence that got tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of votes in the amount of money that they were allowed to contribute to political campaigns. But when you ask most people to enter into a conversation on this topic, they tend to nod off pretty quickly. And in fact, I would recommend to you that if any of you have friends or family who suffer from insomnia, one of the greatest cures in the world is to string together the words campaign finance reform repeatedly, and you'll be surprised at how quickly they nod off. My two colleagues on this panel are both right. They've both argued very persuasively and passionately in favor of a set of principles with which I would agree. The problem is their solutions, of course, are mutually exclusive. Susan talks about the understandable importance of not allowing a moneyed interest, regardless of ideology, to buy an election, to put so much money into one candidate or one cause that it robs the other side of the ability to be heard. And Senator McClintock argues just as persuasively and just as articulately that there is a principle of freedom of speech that if you begin to restrict in the name of financing of campaigns through public funds or through other types of restrictions, you are impeding, and he's exactly right about the results that that occur from that. So they're both right. But, of course, that means that – but their solutions, as I mentioned, are mutually exclusive. So what is the answer? I'd suggest to you that the real root of the problem is not the amount of time the candidates spend raising money for reasons that that Tom mentioned. And the real root of the problem is not a threat to the First Amendment, as Susan may allude to when we get to questions. At the root of this debate is the cost of running campaigns, not the time that it takes to raise money. Not the potential influence of someone who gives to a candidate of one party or another, but the cost of purchasing millions and millions of dollars worth of television and radio advertisements in order to run an effective campaign for statewide or national office. And I'd suggest a middle ground that respects both of the two principles that my two colleagues have laid out. And it's a plan that's forwarded by an organization in Washington, D.C. called the Alliance for Better Campaigns. And what they suggest, Susan, is not public financing of campaigns, because they believe, as do I, that using public taxpayer funds, not for schools, not for roads, not for health care, not for public safety, but for candidates to run negative ads against each other, is not the best way for that money to be used. And what they believe, Tom, as do I, is that while the First Amendment isn't an extraordinary right that ought to be preserved at every opportunity, it is not an absolute right. Because, Tom, when you run for lieutenant governor this year, I could theoretically exercise my right to free speech by following you from event to event, from town to town with a megaphone and loudspeakers. And every time you begin to speak, I could speak louder and louder and louder. I am exercising my right to free speech, but I'm interfering with yours. And just as every right granted to us under the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, these rights are not absolute because we do have to live in a community with others and respect their rights to those same principles as well. So what I would propose is the Alliance for Better Campaign Plan, which instead suggests that the television stations of this state and this nation provide either low-cost or no-cost advertising time for candidates of both parties when they run for election. The television stations of this country have been granted an extraordinary deal by our government. They've been granted access to our broadcast spectrum that cellular companies and any number of others pay millions and millions of dollars for. Television stations get the right to use our airwaves for free. And what I would suggest is, in exchange for that very, very generous gift from our government, we ask them to provide a certain amount of time each election season for every candidate who has met a certain threshold of popular support. Therefore, the candidates are not required to raise millions and millions of dollars because that time for advertising is provided for them. It respects Tom's concerns about freedom of speech. It respects Susan's concerns about the ability of a moneyed interest to buy influence or access into a government. To me, it can respect both of their principles and achieve a practical middle ground.
Okay, thank you very much, panelists. Let me tell the audience what our schedule is for the rest of this session. We're going to have 10 minutes of rebuttal. I'm going to ask the panel some questions. Then we're going to have 20 minutes of your asking questions, and I want you to keep your questions to 30 seconds to a minute, no more than 1 minute. Then we're going to take a vote on whether you agree with any of these people, and so it's going to be a straw vote. Then you're going to break up into discussion groups, and you're going to pick a moderator. You're going to pick a recorder, and you're going to discuss these questions. Does your group think major changes should be made to California's, and we could maybe strike out California, which is, should major changes be made to the campaign financing system? Then you're going to pick somebody to come back and report back to us what you found, and we're going to talk about that for 15 minutes. So we have a very, very packed session here. Now, let me ask some questions, and panel, you can either respond to my questions or among yourself. Now, Susan, Tom raised the whole problem of independent expenditures.
Yes.
How would you solve the problem of independent expenditures? If you provide public money to all these candidates, there can still be huge amounts of independent expenditures made in the campaigns.
Absolutely. I don't want to suggest that we can absolutely solve the problem of independent expenditures. I think to a certain degree the solution will come from improving the quality of the dialogue within the elections, which is something which full public financing helps to do. But I would suggest that full public financing is the only system of campaign financing which attempts to address the challenge of independent expenditures head on. And it does that by providing additional matching funds which go to the publicly financed candidate in very, very quick order once an independent expenditure has been contracted for. Because independent expenditures are often most effective when they are an onslaught that are based on the assumption that the traditionally funded candidate will not have the financial wherewithal to respond quickly, so that there will be a 1, 2, or 3 week lag between the independent expenditure influencing the public and the candidate's ability to get their response back to the voters. And so we look at providing the candidate with an effective and very quick way to respond to independent expenditures, with the hope that it will improve the quality of the dialogue and eliminate some of the very negative advertising, because it's not quite as effective if it's countered very quickly.
Tom, you indicated that disclosure was the solution. And you indicated that most people give out of policy reasons. When we did a study several years ago, we found that the California Medical Association gave to every single returning incumbent, the most conservative legislator, the most liberal legislator, at least $250. Now, they gave to everybody but one. And I called them up, and I said, why did you give all these contributions? They said, well, who didn't we give to? They wanted to know who they hadn't given to. I told them. But answer my question. Why did you give to every single returning incumbent? And their answer was, losers don't legislate. And what we've found is that most of the money given is for access reasons. And the question to you is, suppose the Widget Corporation gives $100,000 to you and to your opponent. How does the public choose then? Haven't they corrupted both of you?
Well, I think the public is perfectly then in a position to assess the positions that each of the candidates has taken, the votes that they've cast if they're incumbents, and determine to what extent the public interest has been set aside for that special interest.
But suppose
that's the whole nature of a democracy.
But suppose that you're given
the of you know, how, in Madison's view, one faction over time tends to balance another. Let's take your analogy a little bit further. You also have in that mix chiropractors, podiatrists, acupuncturists. You have health organizations, hospital groups. You have a huge range, insurance groups, of labor organizations, a huge range of different interests. In the democratic theory upon which we have based our entire system, if that is done in a free environment and people can see it and make their own decisions, that's going to balance out in a rough equilibrium over time.
Let me, if I could
make one other point. The crux of the argument in favor of the restrictions is, particularly in support of either public financing or basically requiring broadcasters to make campaign contributions in kind to candidates. The assumption is, oh, good, now candidates will be spending all of their time in the virtuous pursuit of discussing the issues. That ignores just one tiny little thing, and that is human nature. What those candidates will be doing is spending their time on the phone, raising money for the political party that's planning to put out a big Get Out the Vote drive, the independent groups that may be financing last-minute appeals to voters. And I do reject the notion that somehow you can get money to a candidate fast enough to respond to a sudden last-minute independent infusion of campaign funds. We all know from our personal experience that the most scurrilous pieces of mail usually arrive the last weekend before the election. There's no time to respond even when you have funds on hand, let alone if you have to wait for a public financing mechanism to cut those checks for you. So any way you look at it, you end up with the independent expenditures making those simply taking the place of funds that otherwise would have been given directly to the candidate. The candidate would then be responsible, first of all, for how that money is spent. Again, I think the most civilizing influence on a campaign is the fact that the candidate's name is on that material. And that candidate, win or lose, has got to go back and live in that community with whatever it is they've said. Independent expenditures erase that distinction.
I'm going to have to stop you because I've been told we have to move on. But Susan is
chomping at the bit.
That's right. Okay, go.
Well, first of all, let's see where I want to start with this.
You have 1 minute.
In terms of the actual experience of the candidates, if you talk to people who've run in Arizona and in Maine, and I'm thinking of Mark Spitzer, who is a conservative Republican who ran for statewide office as a clean candidate and is now on the Corporations Commission, what he told us is that it radically changed the way in which he campaigned. And indeed, cleanly financed candidates spend significant amounts of time not on the phone for the party, but in actually going out and meeting donors. It's what they like best about the system and why now approximately 80% of Maine's legislatures, both Republican and Democrat, have taken advantage of public financing. I'd like to point out in terms of what Senator McClintock has pointed out as the balancing factor of democracy, that the result of that balance is something that I'm from Los Angeles, I am very keenly aware of, because if you look at our last mayoral race, people indeed make a determination, but between the candidates, and in our last mayoral race, 70% of the registered voters made that determination of none of the above. They simply stay home, and I think that that is a very significant side effect and a very negative side effect of the constant barrage of this matchup between two loud voices, and the public feels that they have no voice.
Thank you, Susan. I'm going to give Dan 1 minute also. I had a great question for you, Dan, but I'm going to let you respond to both of them. And start lining up over here so we can get the questions going. Dan, you have 1 minute.
Once again, I would just reemphasize that the problem here is the cost of running campaigns in a media-driven society. Independent expenditures under a system such as exists in Los Angeles, in Arizona, or Maine have a tremendous financial advantage over candidates. If you make free or low-cost TV time available to the candidates, the IEs are not having their right to speak restricted in the slightest, but the candidates are restored to center stage because they're buying ads for much less money than a Swift Boat Veterans or MoveOn.org organization can. Second, free TV time means that candidates don't need to rely on the donations from a special interest, whether it's one you agree with or not. Certainly, Tom is right. They will continue to raise money. But candidates still raising money will not necessarily be consumed by it in order to be heard over the din on the airwaves. And finally, the point I'd make in agreement to Tom, Susan, is practically speaking, after 21 years of running campaigns, when my opponent hits my candidate with a last-minute attack ad, right, I'm lucky to have the time to mount a defense. The idea that I would need to apply for funds before I put that response on the air, to me, is just, ideally it sounds great, but practically it's not valid. Once again, I'd say to you, the way to do this is not to restrict the way the money's raised, but eliminate or reduce the need for candidates to spend all their time raising such obscene amount of money for ads.
Dan, I'm going to ask Mark Spitzer to talk to you about his experience with IEs in public financing,
okay,
because he's most articulate on
okay,
that.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, what I'd like you to do, if you could introduce yourself as the questioners, and then direct your question to one or more of the panelists.
I'm Judy.
It's not on.
Nadler. I'm a senior fellow in government ethics at the Markless Center for Applied Ethics. And the question that I have, MoveOn.org has been mentioned, but what I'm seeing now is already a number of e-vites to political events and the use of the internet. And I'm wondering, since that is not exactly disclosable, how do you put a, used to know how much it costs to send a mailer or to send a brochure or whatever, but how do you factor that in, and that's for all of you, in terms of the money spent and the transparency issues?
Well, the transparency issue for the candidate is very clear. You report the money that's received. During the debate we had at Sac State during the recall election, I mentioned my website once at the very close of my presentation. Within 24 hours, we had received over $100,000 in contributions from 11 states and one aircraft carrier. honestly. And I think that that also gives an indication of where campaign funding is going in the future. I think that you are going to see a larger and larger role in small contributions because the internet, for the first time, makes it possible with very little effort for individuals to link up with a campaign and to become an integral part of that campaign over the internet, which again reduces the prevalence of major large contributions in the race when they can be balanced out by many, many small contributions, as easy as simply mentioning it on a broadcast.
What both major parties and what organizations from MoveOn.org to the Christian Coalition have realized over the last few years is that it is much more time and energy efficient to try to mobilize your own supporters to turn out to the polls than it is to try to persuade an undecided voter to support a candidate or a cause of your choice. The internet allows you to target your own supporters and convince them to turn out. So whether it's for fundraising or for grassroots activity, it's something that lessens the need for the extraordinary amount of television advertising that's done in campaigns. So overall, I'd call it a positive. Overall, I'd call it a positive development. It's a great mechanism, as Tom mentioned, for small donor solicitation. And the best part is, of course, the cost of sending out emails is infinitesimal compared to running radio or television ads or even sending direct mail. So the idea of a politician spending 14 hours a day on the phone raising ads for email is at its face and probably not as much of a demand on his or her time.
Next question.
Okay.
You get the answer.
Good morning. My name is Jenny. As we all know that now a campaign is like money is like mother's milk to a campaign. No money and no talk. And it would be helpful if you have a rich in-laws or a wealthy wife. Yep. My question is, according to the Sunlight Act, you said that from Senator McClintock, you said that the special groups can play out each other evenly. My question is, maybe is this a David and Goliath war? And then how could like an average Joe or a blue-collar Jane, I mean, compete with CEO from an XYZ cattle company, ABC oil refinery company in raising funds? And, of course, money breeds power. if I give more, I have direct line to the government representative. And average Joe or average Jane, you may try the government representative office phone number and see whether you get a return call or a pre-printed letter back. I'm wondering, Senator McClintock, do you think that without a Clean Money Act, an average carpenter or a waitress can win a campaign, especially a statewide election where money is the fuel and candidates are burning money like crazy? Thank you.
Well, in my personal career, I've run against five extremely wealthy individuals. It's really hard. I've won two out of those five elections, despite being massively, massively outspent. So it can be done. That's why I think Mark Spitzer likes the public financing. That's why I personally like the public financing idea so well. Mark's an incumbent. I'm an incumbent. We have higher name ID than our challenger, almost certainly. If you can devise a system that limits both of us to the same amount of money, I win. Thank you. Now, to the question, what about that average Joe? How does he possibly compete with the CEO who can make a million-dollar contribution at the drop of a hat? Well, you remember what Lincoln said, God must have loved the common man because he made so many of them. And the fact is that the average Joe and Jane out there every day are doing that, not only by direct contributions that are now as easy as a mouse click on their home computer, but also make them through their labor unions, through the various associations that they belong to. They do that every day. And again, if you leave it alone, it will settle into a rough equilibrium.
I just wanted to say that one of the strengths of the clean money system that we do see in Arizona and Maine is that at least it gives challengers an opportunity to get their name out, to get their message out, and they are not as subject to the kind of incumbency advantage that Senator McClintock is talking about, because where that incumbency advantage most strongly hits is in fundraising capability. And that's not an issue for a challenger under a clean election system. They know they can get their message out.
Next question.
Hi, Ned Wigglesworth with therestofus.org. Just for full disclosure, we're very much in favor of campaign finance laws and reform. A quick point on Bob's earlier parameter for the discussion. There is a case that coming out of the Second Circuit, which just recently approved Vermont's ability to have a mandatory spending limit in its races, which is we're requesting certiorari from the Supreme Court of the United States. That might change. My question is for Senator McClintock. You seem to suggest almost that incumbency is a more pernicious barrier to reflecting the will of the people through elections than money. And I guess I would offer the following stats. Something over 90% of races are won by the candidate that spends the most money versus the last gubernatorial election in California, which the incumbent lost. So incumbency cuts both ways. Incumbency can be good for people if people actually like what they're doing, and also bad. I just wonder if you could address incumbency versus the money.
Well, incumbency, which is basically name recognition, is an important advantage that a candidate can bring into a race. Personal money is a big advantage that an individual can bring into a race. Background is an advantage. There's a market basket of advantages that can be brought in to a campaign. My point is that if you're going up against someone who's got several of those built-in advantages, wealth, name ID, for example, and both of you are restricted to the same amount of money, the guy with the name ID is going to win, almost certainly. And if you, that's basically it. If you limit the amount of contributions a candidate of modest means may accept, that means you've got to go out and chase that many more small contributions until the task simply becomes impossible if you're running against a wealthy candidate. So beware the laws of unintended consequences, which are rife throughout any proposal that limits freedom of people in a society to support the candidate of their choosing and to speak out on issues that they wish to address as citizens.
Next question.
Hi, I'm Paul Turner with the Green Lining Institute. Senator McClintock, you mentioned some key words in terms of the basis for campaign finance in terms of liberty and freedom. Do you think also another basis should be equality, which is inherent in the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Acts of the 60s? And then to you, Mr. Schnur, you mentioned how the cost of campaigns is the primary driver of excessive contributions. But yet, many of our constituents tell us that it's also used to intimidate other challengers. It's used to buy wealthy people, even to maintain their favorability within public policy. How would you then bring about a level playing field so that low-income people can compete to have their voices heard with these well-financed interests?
And you each have a minute to answer that tough question.
Well, I can answer that in a word. It's freedom. It's the ability of people to organize. It's the ability of people to address issues, again, without restrictions being placed on them. That's the whole definition of freedom. And every one of the campaign finance so-called reforms that I've seen are basically proposals to limit people's freedom, to restrict the free expression of ideas, to limit the free expression of positions. Ultimately, I think you will find the most important purifying element in an election is the interest that people take in that election. We saw that during the recall campaign. Massive expenditures that I don't believe amounted to anything. The reason they didn't amount to anything, I was probably outspent 15-1. But I certainly got my message out, as did every one of those other candidates, and the reason was because people were paying very rapt attention. People realized that important issues were at foot, and that's what democracies do. When citizens recognize that approach of a common danger, they rise to the occasion, and they listen directly to the candidates.
Dan?
I'd make two quick points, one to a couple of the questions that have come up on the question of balance. I would point out to you that in California state politics at this very moment, representatives of working-class Californians, representatives of California's nurses, representatives of California's teachers, representatives of California's carpenters, representatives of California's public employees have very much taken the upper hand in the statewide political debate over representatives of business owners, small and large alike. So that balance does exist for the reasons that Senator McClintock talked about earlier. But on both sides, the interest in being involved in the process, whether you are the California AFL-CIO or the California Chamber of Commerce, is because you can provide the necessary funds for candidates to run ads, either to get elected or to pursue their – or to support their policy agendas. Second, and very quickly, to the question of candidates without great means of themselves. You're right. A carpenter, a nurse, a small business owner cannot afford to run for office in this state, and that's because it costs millions and millions and millions of dollars to do so. You make television and radio time available to that person just as toward the wealthier candidate, and I think you'll end up in a much better place. What I'd point out to you by evidence is that in this current upcoming campaign for governor, the state will be faced with a choice between Phil Angelides, a millionaire developer, Steve Wesley, a millionaire eBay executive, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, a millionaire for all sorts of reasons that we don't have time to go into at this moment, whereas Bill Lockyer, the Attorney General, who I disagree with on many members of public many matters of public policy, Bill Lockyer has devoted his entire professional life to public service, and he can't afford to run for governor because it's a lot harder for him to raise the money for the ads. If that time were available to him, then he'd be in this race as well.
All right, here's what I'm going to do. We have five more minutes. I'm going to ask each of you to ask a very brief question. We're not going to, and we'll let them answer the question they want to answer. So very briefly, the rest of you.
Good morning. I'm Charles Marsteller from San Francisco, and I had a question for all the panelists, or particularly Mr. Schnur and Mr. McClintock. I'm wondering how we deal with the evolved political consulting and political attorney in, environment in California and in San Francisco in evasion of our disclosure laws.
Next question.
I wanted to ask Susan the idea that the so-called clean money candidate, I wish there was another name because it makes it sound as if the other candidate is unclean. But if that person, there's an independent expenditure, and then this candidate gets extra money for that, What if there are two independent expenditures or three? What if the people of Arizona rise up in 20 different ways against this candidate? It seems to me that the government of Arizona is saying, every time you rise up against this candidate, we're going to give that candidate more money.
Okay.
That doesn't seem to be right.
Next question.
Leanne Pelham with the Los Angeles City Ethics Commission, and also in light of our recent elections in Los Angeles, I have a question for all panelists about the role of independent spending and whether you have any sense that they may be a victim of their own success. We saw recent backlash with late spending. We've seen significant volume of independent spending, and we've seen negativity in that spending. So I'm wondering if, as we proceed to look at how we ought to be grappling with that kind of issue. If you think that there is a sense that they may be becoming more like negative ads where candidates are increasingly loath to be affiliated or be seen as beneficiaries, what does that mean for the future of possible regulations to try and address that issue?
Thank you. Next question.
This question was going to be directed to Dan, and it was speaking about local campaigns and a look at what this free television advertising would really do in local campaigns where TV ads don't seem to play as significant of a role.
Next question. Last question, and then we're going to have 1 minute each for panelists to answer all those questions.
My name is Kevin Persklove, and I'm a resident of San Francisco. Senator McClintock, I was curious, as your political career has progressed from assembly to state senate and now a statewide office, as well as your run for governor, how much time you are directly spending on deciding where your campaign dollars go, whether they be television, newspapers, prints, pamphlets, or whatever, how directly you are involved as a candidate, how much of that you actually delegate to a consultant. And Mr. Schnur, your comments, please, on this idea of the hopeful idea of free television or free radio. Isn't there such a marketplace now and so much money in California that even if you had your way and television and radio offered that type of time, that you and your fellow colleagues, whether it be Democrats or Republicans, would look for new ways to raise money to spend on initiatives, think tanks, or what have you, to continue to influence the elective process?
Thank you. Now, panel, we're over time already, so you have 1 minute to answer whatever question you want to, but I'm going to stop you 1 minute. Susan?
I think it's obvious that independent expenditures are an important issue. I'd like to talk about that just a little bit. We did have experience with independent expenditures in Maine with if I recall correctly, the first cycle with full public financing. There was an explosion of independent expenditures and a great deal of concern about whether that was going to warp the system. Two things happened. One, the effectiveness of public financing in allowing the candidate to respond quickly to independent expenditures and exactly the kind of backlash which Leanne is talking about. So what I am told by candidates, particularly from Arizona, is not that independent expenditures wither and you don't have them anymore, but that they become a more participatory voice in the process, less mudslinging, more about issues, less about negative campaigning, because the public funding system allows the candidate to respond, and therefore the independent expenditures become a better part of the dialogue and elevate the dialogue rather than debasing the public discourse. It improves the free marketplace of ideas, and that causes people to want to be involved and to vote.
Thank you, Susan. Dan?
Several good questions. The last two are probably the ones that deserve clarification from me. Number one, on the question of the lack of relevance of free TV time for local races. While campaigns at all levels certainly cost too much money, I'm less concerned about the spiraling costs of a campaign for city council or for state legislature than for governor or for United States senator or for president. Certainly in a mayoral campaign, whether it's here in San Francisco or in Los Angeles, once again, it's the cost of broadcast advertising that drives the cost to such an extraordinary degree. And second, to address Kevin's question very specifically, what about candidates who spend large amounts of their own money in addition to the free time provided for them? Once they cross a certain threshold of spending, Kevin, they would no longer be eligible for that free or reduced time. Once again, both of those two questions and more generally, I'd say that if you are going to attempt to either fix or not fix a system, the current system in place, I urge you to look at the root cause. And if you find an alternative way of providing a way for candidates to get their messages out that don't require them raising millions and millions of dollars, odds are they'll spend less time chasing those dollars.
Thank you, Dan. Tom?
Well, I want to address the specter, which is a very real one, of only wealthy candidates being on the ballot. That is exactly the environment that we have created. It used to be, if you were a person of modest means, you could go out and, with a great deal of work, overcome that advantage. But if you limit that candidate to small contributions, the number of donors that they have to chase to overcome a wealthy person's natural advantage simply becomes prohibitive, and that is why you are seeing that trend toward extremely wealthy candidates not only dominating but being exclusively in the field. I go back to an election where we had two wealthy candidates running against a common man in a primary not many years ago. You had Jane Harmon, Al Checkey, and Gray Davis. There were no campaign restrictions. And Gray Davis was able to raise enough money. He didn't spend more than they did, but he was able to raise enough to get his message out, and he prevailed. By placing restrictions on the amount that these candidates of modest means can raise, you have made it impossible for them to overcome the natural advantages that a wealthy individual or a well-known individual brings into the race. That's the law of unintended consequences.
Thank you, Tom.
Just invoked.
My apologies to the panel for really cutting you off. Just be happy I wasn't.